Again, I appreciate you all coming back week after week. And I'm grateful that you're here. We are going to continue. This is week six. Not sure if I had mentioned, but I had some previous commitments that I have to be faithful to that Tim and I have talked through. So I'm gonna do this morning and then two more, and then Tim is going to graciously wrap up kind of following the same theme. And he and I have met two or three times and talked through. I'm really excited about that. he and I are on the same page in so many ways, and I appreciate that. I wanted to make mention of one thing, two things actually. I had a number of people, quite a few actually, ask me about the audio for this, and I've been recording it. I was going to upload it all at once because it's a little bit easier, but I decided to do it separately. So if you know someone that's interested in this or they missed it, they can go to the website and go to the resources link, and then there's a section called audio. And matter of fact, there's about 100 hours of recording there. It's all free. Everything on the website's free. You're welcome to use that. Now, having said that, I am embarrassed to tell you that my daughter-in-law called me last night, and the website is kind of crashed last night. So I'm will put off my Bible hat and put on my webmaster hat as soon as I leave here and go back to my office and try and figure out, get in the bowels of that thing and find out what's wrong with it. Second thing, and I'm only going to mention this briefly because I'm excited about it. I could talk all morning out of it, but Hansa Herr is working on a project with my son Ben, who's in urban ministry. He's been in urban ministry for about a decade. He's usually here, and he's not here this morning, so I can speak freely. But Ben's an awesome writer, and we have partnered together and are doing an urban version of Pilgrim's Progress. If you're familiar with that classic work, but it's 330 years old, Bunyan's work is, but it's a classic story, allegory actually, about the Christian life. And we've been trying to figure out a way to get a lot of the kids that he ministers to involved in that story. But anyway, it's really exciting what's happened in terms of the people nationally that have gotten involved in this. It's never been done before. And our vision is to make it available to urban youth workers eventually. But if you're interested in that book, it won't be out till February, but would want to be interested in just hearing when it's out, if you go to the website, there's a contact link on there. You just click on it, and there's a little form you can fill out, and just in the comments section, just put keep me posted on the book, and I'll be happy to do that. All right, let's go back. We're looking at this series, Men of Like Nature, and I hope more than anything else that as we've gone through this, that you have really begun to see that these are real people living in a real history with real watches on their wrists if they had them, and you and I can relate to them a whole lot more. We had last week we had looked at this guy named Elijah, and three things that we can remember from that. These are right at the top of your page here, but fatigue is the enemy of my soul. There's a direct link between my spiritual health and my physical stamina. And some of us in this room are more familiar with that than others. If you have ever wanted to check out of the Christian life, and if you haven't come to that place yet, I can promise you it's on the road waiting for you, and it will be waving. Elijah is a great example of showing us how our own physical health has an impact on our theology, has an impact on our sense of hope or hopelessness. I think when people get to the place where they want to die, where death is preferable to life, sometimes it's just overwhelming circumstances, but sometimes it's just a loss of perspective. That Proverbs 18:1, that verse I shared last week, I think that, you know, you and I ought to tattoo that on the inside of our eyelids so we don't ever forget it, that he who separates himself seeks his own desires and he breaks out against all sound judgment. Our thinking is definitely affected by that. I also said that isolation was the friend of my enemy. Satan loves to get us alone in our thinking. Just had a wonderful conversation with a dear friend of mine who's in a counseling situation this week over someone that would really wanted to end it all. And after the bushes got pushed away, this person had been in a state of isolation for a long time and listening to themselves think and listening to their own conclusions. He loves to get us alone. And our spouses, for those of us that are married, are not always the best person for us to share this kind of struggle with. Sometimes it needs to be, particularly always needs to be someone of the male gender, but sometimes our spouses are not the right person. Third thing is that rest is something God wants to give us. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, and the whole Sabbath principle. I've told people this before in public, and some of you probably heard me say it, and I wished it had been my idea, but it was my wife's idea, and I've learned to listen to her. I take a tech Sabbath. Saturday night, I turn off my cell phone, and I turn off my computer. And I found, believe it or not, I found that by doing those two things, I take a rest, because I tend to spend time on both of those machines more than I need to. Resting is not something that's in my genes. It just ain't there. I'm one of those guys that used to think it was cool to say I'd rather burn out than rust out. But David Brainerd, who's died in his 30s, is reported to have said, "God gave me a horse to ride and a message to proclaim, and I've killed the horse, and I can no longer carry the message." And I think there's a value in us taking time to rest, all right? It's a famous statement, I don't know who made it, but I love it, that the smallest package in the world is a man wrapped up in himself. That will preach. And this morning we're going to take a look at one such person, a guy named Jonah, who is, I think, the smallest package in the world. And I want to just give a little bit of background on this guy. The first thing, that Jonah is probably one of the best known, really. You could go downtown any city in the United States and ask with a microphone and ask people if they've heard of Jonah. And in a culture that's becoming increasingly biblically illiterate, people don't understand who Goliath and David and things like that are. Most everybody knows about Jonah. But he's also the least studied and probably the most controversial character in the Old Testament, one of the most controversial men, simply because of the supernatural trappings around the story of Jonah have caused people to get so caught up in this story of the fish and all this sort of stuff that they lose track of the message of the book. And I'm guessing that most of us in this room have not taken the time to look at this man, particularly the world in which he grew up in, all right? So that's only true. About this guy, he's the only prophet that Jesus identified himself with. You go through the Gospels and Jesus says that just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And so he picks this guy, to talk about himself, which I think is really significant because it tells us that Jonah was a real person. He had a real dad. His dad's name was Amittai. He had a real hometown. It was Gath Hepher in Galilee. And he had a real problem. Jonah had a real problem. And we're going to spend this morning looking at the problem because Jonah's problem, I think, is ours. And we're going to read some scripture again. I did that last week. Stretched us all a little bit. 3 minutes of reading scripture seems like forever because we're used to drive-through spirituality, kind of like get your burger and go. But we're going to take some time to read this. I've excerpted the story of Jonah out of the Bible, so you could just follow along up here if you'd like. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me." But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. He paid the fare, went on board to go with them to Tarshish away from the presence of the Lord. But the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea. There was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship threatened to break up. Then the mariners were afraid, and each cried out to his God. And they hurled the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship and had lain down and was fast asleep. So the captain came and said to him, "What do you mean, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God. Perhaps the God will give a thought to us that we might not perish." And they said to one another, "Come, let us cast lots that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us." So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. Then they said to him, "Tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. What is your occupation? Where do you come from? What is your country? What people are you?" And he said to them, "I am a Hebrew. I fear the Lord," right, "the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, "What is this you've done?" For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of Yahweh because he had told them. Then they said to him, "What shall we do to you that the sea may be quiet down for us?" And he said, "Pick me up, hurl me into the sea, and the sea will quiet down for you, for I know it is because of me that this great tempest has come upon you." Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. Therefore they called out to the Lord, "O Lord, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not on us innocent blood. For you, O Lord, have done as it pleased you." So they picked up Jonah, hurled him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. The Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of that fish 3 days and three nights. And he prayed to the Lord his God from the belly of the fish, "But I, with the voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. What I vowed, I will pay. Salvation belongs to the Lord." And the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah up on dry land. Then the word of the Lord came to Jonah the second time, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it the message that I tell you." So Jonah arose and went. An exceedingly great city, 3 days' journey in breadth. He began to go into the city, going a day's journey, and he called out, 40 days, and Nineveh shall be overthrown." And the people of Nineveh believed God. They called for a fast and put on sackcloth, from the greatest of them to the least. The word reached the king. He rose from his throne, removed his robe, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat in ashes. When God saw what they did, how they turned from their evil way, God relented of the disaster that he had said he would do to them, and he did not do it. But it displeased Jonah. He was angry, and he prayed to the Lord and said, "O Lord, is not this what I said when I was yet in my own country? That is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and relenting from disaster. Therefore now, O Lord, please take my life from me." Heard this before? "But it is better for me to die than to live." And the Lord said, "Do you well to be angry?" Jonah went out of the city and sat to the east of the city and made a booth for himself there. He sat under it in the shade until he should see what would become of the city. The Lord appointed a plant and made it come up over Jonah that it might be a shade over his head to save him from his discomfort. Jonah was exceedingly glad because of the plant. But when dawn came up the next day, God appointed a worm that attacked the plant and it withered. When the sun rose, God appointed a scorching east wind. And the sun beat down on the head of Jonah so that he was faint, and he asked that he might die, and said, "It's better for me to die than to live." But God said to Jonah, "Do you do well to be angry for the plant?" And he said, "Yeah, I do well to be angry, angry enough to die." And the Lord said, "You pity the plant for which you did not labor, nor did you make it grow, which came into being in a night and perished in a night. And should I not pity Nineveh, that great city in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also much cattle?" All right? That's a chunk out of that story, but it's an amazing, amazing story. What I want to do is for us to take a look. Oops, I'm sorry. I thought that was advancing. You should have told me. A couple things about Jonah, about the man. We're going to look at the man and the mission. And then we're going to take and look at Jonah and ourselves. A couple things about him. The first one is this, and it's really important, that Jonah was a prophet by profession, not election. All right? Not election. I don't want any of you Calvinists to get nervous. I'm not talking about that. That was his job. He was in the ministry. You find this out in 2 Kings chapter 14. It tells us that he was a prophet. It tells us when he was ministering during the time of Jeroboam II. He wasn't like Amos. Amos was out tending his flocks and taking care of sycamore fig trees, and God appeared to him and said, "I got a job for you." And Jonah was not like that. Jonah was in the ministry. He was accustomed to hearing God speak to him. He was accustomed to speaking on behalf of God. This was nothing new. And prophets, beloved, in the Old Testament, their job was to bring the heat. They brought the heat. They stood in the faces of kings and told them what Yahweh wanted them to do. So this was nothing new for him, all right? And secondly, he was not a stranger to Yahweh. He was a servant of Yahweh. He understood God. And we get this from the last chunk that we read. When he tells God why he ran away, Jonah says, is not this what I said to you while I was still with you in my own country? That is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish, for I knew that you were a gracious God, compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and relenting from disaster. Jonah says, I knew you. You and I have a relationship. I knew your heart, Yahweh. And I knew what you would do if I went to Nineveh. You'd spare those suckers. And I'm not going. Now the interesting thing about the phrase that Jonah uses, when he talks about slow to anger and abounding steadfast love, you guys, that is the exact phrase that God used about himself when he hid Moses in the cleft of the rock and he walked by him. He said, I am the Lord, and he said, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. So Jonah is going all the way back to when God first revealed himself to Moses. All right. So he understands the God of Israel. All right. He should have known better. As a matter of fact, he did know better. All right. So this is a guy that's in the ministry. This is a guy that's familiar with God. This is a guy that's being asked to do something that he's been accustomed to doing, and that's delivering the message of God to people who probably don't want to hear it. So we have to figure out why in the world he ran. And there was a reason he ran, and it had to do with the audience. And we're going to take a look at this mission, and I want to break it down for you. Some of this is history, but it's amazing history in terms of what was going on to the place he had to go to. All right. First of all, we can call this mission impossible because of the city itself. All right. Nineveh was one of the oldest and largest cities on the planet. The phrase at the end, 120,000 people who do not know their right hand from their left, more than likely that's a reference to children. More than likely. That was a phrase that was used for kids that were at an age where they didn't quite know. They weren't, we would call it an age of accountability, but at some point they used that phrase for kids that were young, that were real young. So it was a large, large city, all right? Two of its palaces, this is an artist's conception of the city. All right, this is where this guy is, and Gath Hepher in Galilee, where he came from, is Podunksville. I mean, it is rural. Galilee itself is rural, and if you're from Gath Hepher, you're from this rugged country bumpkin, is what he really was. And God calls him not only to the city, all right, but to one of the biggest, nastiest cities on the planet. Right, huge. Huge. 3 days walk around the circumference. They've estimated 60 miles circumference around the city. All right. Second thing about it, just to give you a perspective on this. Two of the kings, one of them that lived before him and one that lived after him, Assyrian kings. If you take the average of their palaces, all right, their palaces average in size 625,000 square feet. All right. The second one was 1 million square feet. The first one was 258,000 square feet. The Biltmore is 175,000 square feet. It's the largest private home in the United States, the Biltmore, if you've ever been there in Nashville. So he's going to places where everything is big. All right, everything is big. It had 5-story walls, had 10-story towers, had a moat around the outside, actually had a double wall system. The outer wall was wide enough for 3 chariots side by side to race around the top. And if you got over the outer wall, it was like shooting ducks on the pond. You were in between 2 walls. So it was just like this impenetrable city. 15 gates. They think it looks something like this. But this is just an invincible city, first of all. The city was. All right. Second part of the mission, what I would call mission imbecile, and that's being anybody in their right mind going to talk to the Assyrians. All right? Plain and simple. They were the religious and political enemy of the Jews for over 100 years. If you study the Old Testament, they had been hammering on that part of the world for a long time. 61 times the word Assyria shows up in the prophets. God continually threatens to use Assyria as his spanking board with his people. And he's going to eventually do it shortly after Jonah. All right, all the way from the time of King Ahab that we looked at last week with Elijah, up 3 kings later to Jehu, The Syrians are mentioned as oppressing the people. And if you go back, and the Assyrians were absolutely anal about keeping war records. Matter of fact, an Old Testament professor here in town, Alan Ross, said, if you want to see what a militaristic state leaves the world, he said, study the Assyrians. See, we basically get no culture from them. We get nothing. We don't even really get art. All of the archaeological finds that they have of the Assyrians, I'll show you a bunch of them here in a second, have to do with war. It was a war machine. And Jehu and Ahab are both mentioned in their war chronicles. And this is the bottom line. They were eventually going to nuke Israel, and everybody knew it. I mean, the handwriting's on the wall. People knew that the Assyrians were on the move. They knew that they were enlarging, and they knew that they were going to go after Israel, which they did, in fact, a few years later. All right. So Jonah's being asked to take a message to a group of people that have been on Israel's blacklist for at least 100 years. Everybody knows that they're coming to nuke them. And basically, you've got not only is he threatening his own lifestyle by having the Assyrians spared, he's also running the risk of falling into the charge of treason. All right, treason. It'd be like an American giving one of our enemies our battle routes or battle plans or escape routes would be better so that they could get out of there before we nuke them. Because God was going to nuke this country, nuke this city, and he sends Jonah to avert that. And so here you have a guy that's running, you know, he's running under the radar of possibly being accused of treason, all right? Second thing, and this is, I had to put this up there. If the Assyrians came to town, it was kind of like the opposite of the Shriners coming to town. All right? When the Shriners come to town, you hear, you know, their stories. Matter of fact, the Shriners and the Assyrians have a lot in common. And it's this. The Shriners, a lot of their public image has to do with building hospitals and caring for people that are sick and bruised and beaten. All right? And the Assyrians would have gladly kept the Shriners busy by providing people for those hospitals. So if you heard the Assyrians were coming to town, it wasn't like the Shrine Circus coming to town. It was a whole lot different, a whole lot scarier. For instance, they tore out tongues and put out eyes, and they're proud of that. Matter of fact, this is an inscription on one of their obelisks showing exactly that. Pulling people, they hauled people around by rings through their noses, rings through their tongues, and put out their eyes. They skinned people alive. I've never had that done, but it doesn't sound like much fun to me. And they thought that was great, so they put that on the sides of walls. You see the guy in the bottom's got a knife just cutting the skin off. So when we look at the archaeological evidence, and there's tons of it. One of the kings had 320 panels like this that filled up his palace. And this is the stuff he looked at when he got up in the morning to encourage him about his reign. All right? Skin people alive, cut off noses and body parts. Another thing, hands and feet laying all over the place. I'm trying to build a little bit of sympathy for Jonah here. God appears to you and says, I got an idea. I want you to go talk to these guys and tell them I'm not happy with them. As a matter of fact, I'm going to overthrow the largest city on earth that's absolutely impenetrable, and these people are not even going to be remotely happy that you're coming. All right? Another thing, they built pyramids out of human heads. Interesting pastime. But these are the people that Jonah was sent to. All right, this is an imbecilic mission, not just an impossible mission. All right, it's also mission improbable because of the missionary. It's probably not going to happen because of Jonah. All right. And this is a mind-blowing thing about this book. If you read the book of Jonah, we read a good chunk of it. He is the only created thing in the book that disobeys God. And he's the prophet. He's the guy that knows God. He's the man in the ministry. All right? The sea obeys God. All right? The fish obeys God. And I've told people before, if I was God, I would have sent a great white. But, you know, the fish obeys God. The sailors not only obey God, they come to faith. God uses Jonah's disobedience, his disregard. He's asleep for crying out loud in the bottom of the boat when everybody's going ballistic on the top. They come to faith. All right? Now that's encouraging that God can use you and I in a state of disobedience for his purposes, because he's God. All right? He's God. The Ninevites, from the people to the king, obey God. Right? The plant obeys God. Right? The worm obeys God. And the east wind obeys God. You read through this book, and Jonah's the only thing in the book that doesn't obey God. The chances of this mission being accomplished don't seem real likely. He's got a whole series of plans. All right? First one, plan A, is to catch a fast train out of Dodge, basically. Or in this case, a fast ship to Tarshish. Now, if you look at a map, all right, if you look at a map, it'd be like God saying, I want you to go to Denver, and you go to Boston. That's the way it is. All right? Nineveh's over here. Tarshish is over here. It was the farthest known point in the world at that time. Solomon had ships that came all the way from there carrying baboons and peacocks and all kinds of crazy stuff. So it was out there. So that's plan A. All right? That fails. God sends a storm. All right? Plan B is what I call sailor-assisted suicide. Don't even remotely look at Jonah as being a messianic figure here. It's because of me that this storm has come upon you. And if you throw me into the water, the sea will be calm. I'm willing to lay my life down for you. That's bogus. All right? Jonah, plan B is Jonah said, I still ain't going. I ain't going to Nineveh. All right? He wasn't planning on swimming to shore at that point. Jonah was planning on dying, and that didn't work. All right? So he went to plan C. God finally got him. You know, the fish did what you and I would do. It puked him up, all right? And keep in mind, it's a 300-mile walk. Please keep in mind, 300-mile walk from the coast to Nineveh. All right? Some people, you read the story and it sounds like he spit him up and he kind of dusted himself off and walked into Nineveh. All right? If that happened, the whale spit him 300 miles, and I'm guessing when he landed, he wouldn't be of much use to God. So it was a 300-mile walk, all right? But when he gets there, you got to look at this message. There's 1,300 words in the book of Jonah. His sermon is eight. Eight words. 30 days and Nineveh will be overthrown. That's it. It's five words in Hebrew. And I don't picture him passionately preaching this. I don't picture him, you know, like John the Baptist. I kind of picture Jonah kind of going through Nineveh going 30 days, 30 days, 30 days. I don't think his heart's in this. There's evidence near the end of the book that his heart's not in this. So I think he thinks, well, I'll just throw out the minimal message. And a revival breaks out among these, you know, among these pagan killers, all right? Then plan D is kind of Yahweh will take my way. What do I mean by that? You know, he changed his mind. So we get to the end of the book, and Jonah, God, the whole city repents, and Jonah goes and sits outside of the city. Why? To see if maybe God would change his mind. And maybe he'll sit out there on the side of the city and fire will fall down from heaven and consume the city of Nineveh. Maybe Yahweh's like me. And so the chances of this whole thing taking place, the city, the war machine, and Jonah is really, really slim. All right, I just don't think it's going to happen. Take it a step further. All right, what can we learn from this thing? What can we get? What can we lessons from a pathetic prophet? There's some stuff in here for us regarding a couple emotions, and I'm going to touch on those as we go through this. All right. First thing, and I've coined a new word here. It's not in any theology books, and I'm not sure it'll fly, but I like it. By the way, this is a picture of Jonah from the Sistine Chapel. Fish and the whole bit is there. Number one, Jonah was a gracist. A gracist. What's a gracist? A gracist is a person that uses grace to segregate people rather than to sanctify. A gracist. All right? Segregation and sanctification have one thing in common. They both involve setting people apart in groups. To sanctify means to be set apart for God, to be set apart from sin and set apart from God. Segregation occurs when one people group makes a determination about another people group that they can't be part of group A. And Jonah was a gracist in the sense that he wanted to use grace as a determining factor between who's in and who's out. All right? A gracist is a person that looks at the world and sees two kinds of people, Christians and non-Christians. All right? If you and I think that way, we're gracists. All right? There's really only two kinds of people in the world. There's sinners who have received grace, and there's sinners who have yet to receive grace and have not received grace. But you and I constantly have in common the one thing that unites us with the rest of the human race, and they know it, and that's that we're sinners. As I stand here 37 years after I came to Jesus Christ, I stand here today, I'm a lot better person than I was before. All right, as a foul-mouthed doper, arrogant, and right now I'm a lot nicer person, but I'm as damned apart from the blood of Jesus as I stand here 37 years later as I was 37 years ago. I stand before you as a person who's received grace. And I stand in grace. And if God were ever to withdraw His grace from me, I would be playing golf in the lower elevator. All right. And a gracist, Jonah was, there was a we they mentality. And God, you guys, God is in the process of pushing out the boundaries of the covenant right here. And Jonah says, I ain't doing it. I ain't doing it. Second thing about Jonah, he had a notion of nation. He had a notion of nation that had blinded him to God's passion for people. You could say that Jonah was a patriot. Some people would say that he was a patriot. But Jonah had put the nation of Israel, his own national identity, ahead of God's plan for Nineveh. God has a passion for people. People are the only thing that matter to God other than His glory. And God told, you see this at the end of the story, beloved. It's so sad. You know, I mean, this is one of those books that you just wish, you know, it's like a page fell out of it. It just ends really ragged. We don't have any idea what happened to Jonah. No idea whatsoever. You know, is he in heaven? Is he going to be in heaven? I don't know. I don't know. Story ends that way. And I think the story ends that way on purpose. But God says, you had compassion, same Hebrew word. You had compassion on this plant, and you don't want me to have compassion on these people. Jonah was so concerned about his own national identity that he lost track of the bigger purposes of God. And beloved, that is a temptation that we face, particularly in America. Lose track of the fact that our citizenship is in heaven, and we have to be associated with the will and purposes and plan of God for people. More so than the nations. Third thing, he lost sight of the purpose of the covenant in the face of the perks of the covenant. Jonah was really excited to be one of God's covenant people. But the purpose of God's covenant, according to Genesis 12, God said, I'm pouring out my grace on you so that you can be a conduit of grace to the world. That's what he told Abraham. I'm going to bless you so that you all by you all nations of the world will be blessed. And God was beginning to push this out. Amazing, amazing parallel. It's not in your notes, but an amazing parallel is that about 700 years later, Peter's at this exact same spot, honestly, geographically, the same spot. He's at the city of Joppa, which is where Jonah caught his boat. And God asked Peter to take the gospel to the Gentiles. A guy named Cornelius is in the city. And Peter does it. He has that vision of the unclean food and all that stuff coming down. And I mean, I can't prove this because I wasn't there. And I know when I get to heaven, it's not going to matter. So I'm not going to say I'm going to ask him when I get there. That's a joke. But Peter may have thought about Jonah when he's at Joppa. It may have dawned on him. But sometimes you and I sometimes get lulled into thinking that the gospel is all for us. And the gospel is really for the glory of God, and it's for them. It's for people outside these walls. And Jonah lost track of that. Jonah was grateful to be in the covenant, the perks, but he had lost track of the purpose of it. And God is always about pushing out the boundaries of the covenant. There's a guy made a statement that Christians are not the end users of the gospel. I love that phrase. We are not the end users of the gospel. So we can get stuck in the same thing that Jonah did. Third thing, and I think this is important for us. Jonah's depression. Jonah lost his joy. He lost his joy seeking his own comfort rather than the compassion for others. Matter of fact, there's an amazing parallel between Jonah and Jesus. Jesus rides into Jerusalem and weeps over the city. He weeps over the city. Jonah sits outside the city of Nineveh waiting for God to destroy it and really prays for the destruction of his enemies is what he's doing. And Jesus told us to pray for our enemies. Jesus said, whoever seeks to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake in the gospel will save it. Matter of fact, one of the things that lifted me out of the depression, and I told you early on that it lasted a long time, a couple years, but one of the things that lifted me out of it was coming across a passage in Isaiah 58, verses 10 and 11. It said, if you pour yourself out for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then shall your light rise in the darkness, and your gloom will be like the noonday. The Lord will guide you continually. He'll make your bones strong, and he'll satisfy you with pleasant things in scorched places. You will be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters fail not. And God said, friend, the path to healing out of this depression is giving yourself rather than spending more time thinking about yourself. It's real interesting. Brennan Manning, in a book, Ruthless Trust, said that people who have low self-esteem spend all their time thinking about themselves. So he said it's not that they don't think highly of themselves. He said they think too much and too often about themselves. People who have a proper understanding of their relationship to God, they just don't think about themselves, period. And Jonah was really self-absorbed. He was really self-absorbed. Second thing here, all right, and I want you to see this because this is where the cookies are on the bottom shelf. Jonah's real journey was not from Joppa to the ocean and back to Nineveh. Jonah's real journey was from resentment to anger to depression. And a whole bunch of people, I can't find out who said it because they all claim to have said it, and I know that they didn't all say it, but someone has said that depression is frozen rage. That depression is frozen rage. And I know in my own life, in light of some of the stuff I've shared with you already, if there's a battle for me going on right now, it has to do with anger. And I'm finding that the longer I ponder my angry thoughts, the more I think about them, the more depressed I get. And Jonah was there. Jonah's real issue was resentment. And here's what resentment is. This is not in your notes, but resentment, I thought of this on my scooter on Highway 280, if you can imagine coming home yesterday. That's a scary thought. It only goes 40 miles an hour. So it's the result of not letting God be God. That's where resentment comes from. And resentment leads to anger, and anger leads to depression. But resentment is the result of not letting God be God. God said, go to Nineveh. I want to save these people. And Jonah said, uh-uh. I'm not going to. And there are things in your life probably where God has brought something into your life or taken something out of your life. And the tendency is for you and I to just not let him be God. And the pathway back from depression, the pathway back from anger, is for you and I to bow before God and say, you are God and I am not, and I don't understand this. All right? Because we don't really know. We don't know what happened to Jonah. Have no idea what happened to this guy. And I think God leaves that hanging just the way it is on purpose so that you and I, as we read this book, will have to wonder. We know what happened to the Ninevites, and we know what happened to the sailors. They came to faith. All right, their life improved. Not forever. I mean, the Ninevites, obviously, they got awful, and God ended up nuking them with the Babylonians a few years later. But for us, I think the issue here, I would tell you that, and if any one of you that's in the ministry in here, and we all are to a certain extent, resentment is one of the key assassins of people in the ministry. And resentment results from you and I failing to let God be God. And I think Jonah is a great example of someone who got depressed because they allowed themselves to get angry over God's goodness to someone else that they didn't think deserved it, and they were resentful over that. And at some point, you and I can relate to that, I think. There's a number of questions there for you guys to bounce around. Let me close in prayer, and we'll go from there.